Appeals. On our docket this morning at our 9 o'clock docket, we have case number 2007 CA2443, People Against McAllister. And following that, we have case number 2008 CA1919, Equitable Building Against Oddfellows. Our counsel here, and is your opposing counsel here as well? Good.
Yes, sir.
All right. Right. Thank you. Counsel, all four of you, have you received and read our standard instructions? Do you have any? Thank you. Do you have any questions? All right. Everyone, please check your cell phones or pagers and turn them off. We will begin.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Kenny, registration number 40066, and I represent the defendant appellant in this case, Mr. Kevin McAllister. I'd like to discuss the first issue in my brief, variance, but if the court has any questions about the other two issues, I'd be happy to answer those as well. The facts in this case are clear and undisputed. The only issue was intent, and that was acknowledged by counsel both at trial and here in the appellate process. Mr. McAllister was charged with theft on January 3rd, 2005. The prosecution argued an opening consistent with that information. However, by closing argument, the prosecution argued to the jury, quote, regardless of what he had meant to do on the 3rd, by the time we sit here today, she has not been paid back. Now, Mr. McAllister was not charged with a continuing offense of theft. Thus, a verdict based on any date other than the 3rd is inconsistent with the information.
How does that statement convert it to a continuing offense or somehow suggest that his intent on a different date should be looked at? The statement that the prosecutor made that you just read to us. That's what I'm having trouble with in understanding your argument.
How the variance arises from that statement. Well, the argument,
regardless of what, I forget exactly what he said.
Of what he meant to do on the 3rd?
Yeah.
Well, that is specifically telling the jury that the intent formed on the 3rd is irrelevant to the theft, that they can find that a theft occurred even if Mr. McAllister did not intend to permanently deprive Ms. Mueller on the 3rd, and that is not what was charged. What was charged was both the actus reus and the mens rea on the 3rd only. Now, the theft statute tells the prosecution generally that it is sufficient to charge theft on or about a date certain, and that if that is not clear enough, that then it's the burden of the defense to request a bill of particulars. But here, the information was even more clear, and that is an act of prosecutorial discretion. And it indicates that rather than the general theft charge, which depending on the theory of the case can be a continuing offense, here it was one date only, and that one date is January 3rd, the date and the information. However, this court has addressed both continuing offenses and non-continuing offenses that contain prejudicial variances, and the analysis has been the same. Lopez was a case where the charge was failure to register a continuing offense, and it was charged on or about date certain. But the defense to that charge was that the defendant was incarcerated on his date of registration and the jail would not allow him to register there. Now, the court found that the prosecution's closing argument, the defendant's failure to register as of date of trial, created a prejudicial variance because it rendered the defense irrelevant, even though in that case there was greater notice of the possibility that other dates could be involved. This case is more closely analogous, actually, to Vassallo Hernandez, which was not a continuing offense. That was a criminal impersonation case that was charged on a single date, just like this case. And the defense in that case was that when the defendant was arrested and gave a false name, he was too intoxicated. It was voluntary intoxication. However, in closing, the prosecution argued that the jury could convict him because when he bonded out 2 days later, he used that same false name. And the court found that that was a prejudicial variance because it rendered the intoxication defense irrelevant and was not what was given notice of in the information.
Here, excuse me, here the prosecution started with January 3rd. How is a statement in closing that as of the date of trial he has not paid inconsistent with January 3rd? In other words, I, the prosecutor, am arguing to you that he never intended on January 3rd, and even as of today, he hadn't paid, which is proof that he never intended to play in the first place.
Well, you can use later actions as circumstantial evidence of intent on the date charged. However, the prosecution's argument and in rebuttal argument, they list all of the months between the date of the charge and the date of trial. And the prosecution says, quote, he sits here through counsel, says he didn't intend to do it, people can't prove it. Folks, the proof is in the pudding. He still has Ms. Mueller's $600. And there's no reason for you to think, but for being here today in this courtroom, and but for you looking at the evidence and saying he's guilty of theft, there's nothing in this man's track record to indicate to you that he would have paid her back. He stole it. Now, the fact that she still hasn't been paid is not relevant to the charge. The issue here is intent. And his intent as formed on the 3rd is the only issue that he was given notice of and the information that he had to defend against. And his defense was specific to the 3rd. The defense did not address his intent on later dates or try to bring in evidence to explain away failure to pay in the interim. The defense was specifically targeted to the information, which stated January 3rd was the relevant date for the intent.
He was not prevented from arguing that, was he, in any way, from presenting a defense?
No, he was not argued, wasn't prevented from arguing that defense. However, the way the courts have analyzed prejudicial variance is not whether you were given the opportunity to offer the argument, but whether the prosecution's change in argument rendered your defense irrelevant by the date of trial.
What case is that?
Those are People v. Lopez and People v. Versalo Hernandez. And the...
Okay, I know those cases.
Those are the cases that look specifically and only at whether the defense was rendered irrelevant.
Don't those cases say that the test is whether you are prevented from presenting a defense or can I use it as a bar to a later prosecution?
Well, they do describe the notice and the information that way, but in both of those cases, there was a closing argument, and the closing argument was relevant to the information. It was the prosecution's argument and the variance in what the jury could find guilt on that rendered the defense irrelevant, and that was what deprived the defendant of his opportunity to present a defense, not the opportunity merely to offer a defense, but that this defense, which answered the information, should also have been able to answer the case that the prosecution argued to the jury. And in this case, Mr. McAllister's defense answered the information, but not the closing argument. And we know that the jury was influenced by this closing argument and understood it to be an argument that they could find guilt on other dates because of the question that they offered to the court. In their deliberations, they asked the court, does it matter when his intent was formed? Does it have to be on the 3rd? And the court's answer to them did not actually clarify what their finding had to be. The court's answer contained, just like the original instructions, both a continuing offense answer and the information answer. The court said it needs to be on or close to the date charged, and then it referred them back to instruction number 2, which stated the date on January 3rd.
The defendant object to that response?
No, we objected to the initial instruction, which told the jury that they could find the defendant guilty on or about January 3rd. That was the theft elemental instruction. However, and we were overruled in that objection. However, in discussing the jury's question, the trial court explained to the prosecution that this was the answer he was going to give because a jury finding related to any date other than the 3rd, any finding of intent other than the 3rd, was not consistent with the information, and
other
they could not.
Other than on or about the 3rd.
Right. And in this case, there's a cluster of dates close to the 3rd on which the jury reasonably could have found guilt. his failure to appear on those subsequent dates. And presumably that is what was the hang-up in their deliberations, was that they had these other dates which could they could have found intent formed by the 6th. However, that was not the charge offered up to Mr. McAllister. And if there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for
Ms. Kenny. I do have a question. If you had offered evidence that he had paid 6 months later, would that not be evidence that he intended to pay? In the beginning, he had intended to pay, and his payment 6 months later demonstrated that he intended to pay.
Well, yes, that would be circumstantial evidence of an intent not to permanently deprive on the 3rd. However, Your Honor, because of the way that the information was stated, that kind of evidence, while circumstantially relevant, doesn't have the same weight as if this was charged over a broader period of dates, giving extra importance to defending against the actions of the 3rd, presenting some sort of evidence about why he didn't show up on the 6th or why he didn't show up on the 15th.
But my question is, if it would be relevant to for you to show that he paid 6 months later as circumstantial evidence that he did not intend to permanently deprive, why is it not okay for the prosecution to say, well, he never paid, and that's circumstantial evidence that he never intended, that he certainly did intend to permanently deprive?
Well, that element of the statement is consistent with the information and okay. the evidence admissible for theft. However, the first part of the prosecution statement is where the harm comes in, of regardless of what he meant on the 3rd, that is what is inconsistent on the information. That is what allows the jury to make a finding on a date other than the 3rd.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Alice Hosley on behalf of the people, registration number 32195. The issue is intent. It's the only issue that was at issue and undecided. However, the point of this case and why we're here is whether or not there was a variance. There was no variance constructed in the presentation of the elemental instruction. The charging document was consistent with the evidence that was presented at trial. Neither opening argument nor closing argument are evidence presented, and the jury is instructed as such.
Was it the people's theory that he did not have the intent on January 3rd?
That's not correct. The people's theory was that his intent was formed on the 3rd when he took the check, that he never intended to buy a furnace, that he never intended to install the furnace.
I think we're saying the same thing. He never intended on January 3rd to pay for that.
Correct, to install the furnace. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Okay, the question then becomes, what about these other statements that the district attorney made, the prosecutor made?
The statements that were made by the prosecution that have been highlighted are both in opening and in closing argument. Neither one is evidence that was presented during the trial period. They're both in argument. Secondly, the complaint and the information was consistent with the date, the evidence that was presented, the date that the check was accepted. I think it's important to note here that the only reason Ms. Mueller gave the check to the defendant was based on his representation that she needed a new furnace in the first place. So his representations that he would buy a furnace, that he would install a new furnace, and that she needed one in the first place were all of the evidence presented later of his subsequent conduct is an inference that he never intended to do it on that date. Subsequent conduct is allowed to prove intent on a prior date, and that is the date that the intent was formed, January 3rd. is consistent with the charging document, is consistent with the charging instruction, the jury instruction number two, which stated that the crime was committed on January 3rd. So the facts of this case, the evidence that was presented was consistent with the charging document. There was no variance to begin with.
Ms. Holsey, is it your position that the prosecutor's closing argument can never cause a variance? I thought I heard you say that at first.
Well, I think that it is, you need to look at the definition of a variance and consider what would be required for a variance, okay. A simple variance to be reversed.
My understanding of the defendant's theory here is not the issue about whether he's protected from a second prosecution. It has to do with the first prong. Was he deprived of fair notice of what the charges were against him? Now, the indictment certainly said the event happened on whatever it was, January 2nd, January 3rd. But in the closing argument, what did the prosecutor mean when he said, or she said, regardless of what Mr. McAllister had meant to do on the 3rd, and I interpret meant to mean intent, regardless of what Mr. McAllister intended to do on the 3rd, as we sit here today, she hasn't been paid back. Does that argue for intent on a different day that is a variance from the indictment that they weren't on notice of? I think that's their theory.
Well, I can't speculate exactly what the prosecutor, what they meant by their choice of words. However, the facts in this case as presented are consistent with the charging document. If a variance, if the prosecution can indeed create a variance, not through evidence presented, but through closing argument, there are still several prongs that need to be met. And the first one is prejudice. The defendant needs to show that they were prejudiced. And in order to show prejudice, they need to show that there was a material alteration in what they were charged with and what they had notice to present a defense of. Opposing counsel has represented that his defense was date specific to January 3rd. I would take issue with that based on the evidence at trial and her opening brief, which states that on page 5, actually his intent, his defense was that he never intended. He cross-examined witnesses to explain, I had family problems, I had professional problems.
Well, he always intended to do it. I mean, he always intended to either put in the furnace or repair.
He never intended to permanently deprive.
Right, okay. And there are those different dates in the course of the case.
Correct. So if indeed a prosecutor can create a variance through a closing argument, you still need to look at whether or not that prejudice, whether or not the variance created a prejudice. And in this case, it clearly did not, because he did not argue a specific date defense. He argued that the intent never occurred throughout the entire. He had notice. He knew that the cop and the victim were both going to testify. He presented cross-examination based on the defense of never intending, as opposed to the intent on date specific.
He argued that my intent on days later than January 3rd was to return the money or to install the furnace. That was really my intent.
Right.
Okay. And the prosecutor argued that was never your intent.
Right. On January 3rd, you took the money, never intending to install the furnace. His defense was, I intended to install it, and when I stopped intending to install it, I intended to return the money based on these conversations that I had, subsequent later conduct to prove intent. So how this all boils down is that the defendant has failed to show that he would have presented a different defense in any other way had he been given notice that the honor about language was sufficient and was going to be argued.
The defendant's argument is, I didn't have a chance to do that because this didn't show up the closing argument. In other words, the prosecution had been arguing January 3rd until closing argument, and by then it was too too late. The evidence had been closed.
And the flaw with that argument is that they argued all the way through trial, all the way through all their examinations of the witnesses, that the intent was never formed. They did not argue a date specific all the way through trial and then, oh my gosh, this is a surprise at closing argument. They argued, the defense also argued consistently all the way through trial that the intent was never formed, not date specific to January 3rd.
Can you give us a record cite for where he says it's never formed?
Well, I can give you the opening brief, page 5, states that the defendant's defense was that he never informed the intent. I think that can also be bolstered by the cross-examination of the witnesses, in which evidence testimony was elicited that he had been giving reasons and explanations for not following through. At each step, every explanation he gave him more time, gave him a little more space. January 6th, it was the victim who called him to say, where are you? You're supposed to install my furnace today. Oh, I can't do it today. I need help carrying it. Let's reschedule. On the date that it was rescheduled, she called him again to say, where are you? This is the day we rescheduled. Again, he says, you know what? I'm not going to be able to install it. I'll return your money. When the cops called him, he said, you know what? I acknowledge this debt, but it's going to take me 3 weeks to get her the money back. All of these comments bought him more time, which eventually led to him fleeing the state and going to Arizona. For whatever reason, I have no idea what was the impetus for that. However, each step along the way bought him more time, and that was his defense. He never throughout the case did he intend to deprive her of her money. So I think that's really the crux of this case, is was it a date-specific defense? If so, was he prejudiced in not being able to argue it? I think the record and the facts and the presentation of the defense was that he never intended. It was not date-specific, and therefore no prejudice occurred. He's not on appeal given any indication of what he would have argued differently had he been given notice. So if indeed a prosecutor's vague statement in the closing argument can create a variance, this case is not a case where that variance was made prejudicial.
In opening statement, the defendant said that he that his actions on January 3rd were done in the course of business, and in good faith he intended to do what he said he would do. Why isn't that a focus on January 3rd? And I think in jury instructions conference, he also objected to some of the instructions because it was a focus on January 3rd.
The defense did object to the elemental instruction because it had the at or about language, which is consistent with the statute. However, the jury heard this whole, all of it, all the opening statements. They were allowed to decide what they believed. It can certainly be the defendant's argument that he never intended, but his argument is certainly a reasonable inference from the facts. However, I think it's a more reasonable inference based on the subsequent conduct that he never intended to do so. He made the argument throughout trial that he was either going to install it or he was going to pay the money back. He never did. And the jury heard all of that evidence, all of that information. They also heard the circumstances surrounding that defense and those comments. But again, the defense is made that he never intended to permanently deprive. It was not date-specific to January 3rd.
Ms. Halsey, there were only, as I understand, there were only two witnesses at this trial, the victim and the police officer?
Yes.
Defendant did not testify?
Correct.
The victim was cross-examined by defense counsel on conversations she had after January 3rd, where the guy, for lack of a better term, he sort of strung her along. The cop testified and was cross-examined by the defense counsel about what the defendant told him, about I'm trying to make the payment, I'm in Arizona, I'm all this. Based on those that testimony, the defense counsel argued in closing that there was no evidence of intent to permanently deprive, because all along this time he was really trying to get the money back, he was just unable to do so.
There was also a tape played, a recording that the police had from his conversation that was played at trial.
That corroborated the police
officer. That corroborated the police officer's statement. So even though it was not the defendant's testimony at trial.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It was evidence presented based what his intent was that a reasonable inference could have been.
Who offered the tape? The defense or the prosecution?
Prosecution. It was done during the police officer's testimony.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I'll thank the court for its time.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to first address a few representations of fact. The defendant did not flee to Arizona. He informed the victim in January when he spoke to her that his son was having problems in Arizona. And that was part of what was going on with him after January 3rd, so there was not flight in this case. And the defendant's representation that she needed a new furnace was a correct representation. She ultimately did replace her furnace. That was not a false representation on his part.
Can I ask you a question on the what I think is at issue here, and that's the intent question?
Mm-hmm.
On page 5 of your opening brief, you say Mr. McAllister's defense was that he did not have the intent to permanently deprive the alleged victim of her money. That does not seem to be date specific.
I need to apologize that my statement in my brief was not specific enough. That was an oversight on my part. The defense did, in cross-examining witnesses, address the intent evidenced by his actions on the 6th and the 15th. But that the evidence of those dates is circumstantial evidence of his intent on the 3rd. So it's still vital to his defense regarding the 3rd to cross-examine and try and get across his position regarding his actions on the 3rd. And I'd like to direct the court there. When the court has addressed a case where a defendant is charged with theft and alleges that the offense is actually a civil case instead, it looks to two elements. The first is whether the defendant failed to perform, which we do have in this case. And the second element is whether the defendant formed the relationship never intending to perform. And that is what the defense was in this case, that there was never an intent not to perform on January 3rd. So the subsequent actions are important. Now that case, the facts of that case were that a gentleman sold a used car misrepresenting the mileage. And the court found that that was a material misrepresentation from the beginning, and the defendant never intended to enter into a legitimate business transaction because the victim said, but for the representations about the mileage, he wouldn't have bought the car. Now in this case—
Isn't that the same case here?
No, Your Honor.
His representation, she'd never have given him the money.
Well, the issue is whether it was a misrepresentation.
Exactly. And isn't that for the jury?
Well, it's for the jury to decide on January 3rd whether, in the event when he is making the arrangements with Ms. Mueller, whether he intended to perform on the 3rd or not, not on the 6th. And we know that the jury was swayed by this argument that it could have, that the intent could have been formed on these other dates because of the question to the court. They were never clearly informed that they had to make the finding specifically as to the 3rd, or else the defendant was not guilty of the offense charged. They were confused about that. They told the court that they were confused about that, that the timing of the intent was a crucial element of their deliberations, and they were never clearly instructed that it had to be with respect to the third. And because of that, Mr. McAllister's defense was irrelevant. The jury in Lopez asked a very similar question and got a similar answer from the court, and containing both the on or about language and the specific date. And as I mentioned previously, in those cases, the court looked specifically at whether the prosecution's argument rendered the defense irrelevant. While the instructional issues do have bearing as to whether there was the prejudice and whether the prosecution's burden was decreased by this change in argument, the central issue here is whether the defense that he did not intend to permanently deprive on the third was properly considered by the jury in light of the prosecution's argument. I see my time has expired. We ask that you reverse his conviction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. This case now stands submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.